All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thanks, everyone, for coming to the session today. My name is Jeff Mieliff, and I'm going to apologize from the outset. My voice, a little bit hoarse today. I'm going to take things as slow as I need to in order to remain hydrated. I'm getting over a little bit of a cold that I caught on the plane on the way over here. But we're going to get through the session. I do have a lot of content to get through today. So we're probably going to run pretty much right until the end. I expect that I will have time for a couple of questions, but I will be at Ask the Experts later this evening if you do have more questions that we can't answer here. And I'm also going to throw my email address, my direct email address, up on the projector towards the end. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm more than happy to have a one-on-one conversation and make sure we get all of your questions answered. So hope everyone's having a great time at Tech Ed. I love Barcelona. This is one of my favorite cities in the world to visit, so I'm super happy to be here. So in terms of what we're going to talk about today over the next little bit more than an hour, we're going to go into three main categories of content. We're going to talk about how to optimize Exchange 2013 to get the best performance out of your system, thinking about things like sizing properly, some of the tweaks that can be made within the product to ensure that you're actually going to get the best bang for the buck and get the most out of the rather expensive hardware purchase that you've made to run Exchange on. We're going to talk about troubleshooting, what to do when you run into a performance problem, how you can actually try and dig into what the root cause of that performance problem is and understand what's going on under the hood. And we'll talk about trending a bit towards the end. So how to actually collect data on an ongoing basis, understand how your system's performing so that you can make predictions and have an understanding of when you might need to buy new hardware or more hardware in order to keep up with growth in your environment. That's a high-level overview of what we're going to talk about. And like I mentioned, we are going to have a little bit of time for questions towards the end. So before we get started, I have a question for everyone here. How many of you have started deploying Exchange 2013? Wow. I have to say I'm actually kind of surprised by that. How many of you have actually finished deploying Exchange 2013? Okay, fantastic. That's excellent. And how many of you in the room are actually planning to go fully into Office 365 and not run any on-premises servers? Okay, good. I was going to suggest another session for you. Okay, perfect. Really happy to see folks starting to deploy 2013. It's been a little bit of a slow uptake for the 2013 product compared to some of the others that we've had, but we're really just now starting to see things ramp up. So your answers reflect that. So when we think about optimizing Exchange 2013 and really any version of Exchange for performance, there's really one most critical thing that you need to consider, and that's sizing. So most of you in the room raised your hands when I asked if you were in the process of deploying 2013. I'm hoping, given that you're already at that point, that you've gone through the sizing process, you understand what the guidance is that we've released, and you've thought long and hard about what exactly it is that you need to provide to Exchange for Exchange to do its job. We have a lot of guidance out there on the web today. It's not perfect. I wrote it. I'm happy to say that it's not perfect. But it's fairly comprehensive, certainly compared to some of the other products that we offer. And ignoring that guidance upfront is really the best predictor of the potential for running into performance problems down the road. So if you're coming from Exchange 2010 or 2007 or 2003, 2013 is a very different product. And understanding the nuances and how to properly go through that sizing process, really critical. So there's a couple of links down here at the bottom of the screen. The first one is a recording of a session that I did at the Microsoft Exchange Conference earlier this year, specifically on sizing. It's an hour and 15 minutes on sizing.
I'm sorry, I know you're a little worse, but is it possible to increase the audio from over there so that you don't have this?
Yeah, apparently some folks are having a hard time hearing because of the crossover. So if we can do something about that, that'd be great. And I'll try and speak up as much as I can as well. Sorry about that. So first link is an hour and 15 minutes just on sizing. Doesn't go into any of the content that I'm talking about here today. The second link is the documentation on sizing on the Exchange Team blog that walks through step by step how to think about sizing, what all the calculations are, what all the formulas are. I actually don't want anyone in this room to ever have to go through that process manually. That is very difficult and fraught with possibility for mistakes. That's why we have the role requirements calculator, which is the next most important thing to think about when you go through sizing Exchange. So this is an Excel spreadsheet. How many of you have used the role requirements calculator? Okay. That's less hands than I saw raised for people deploying in 2013, so that worries me. This is a free tool to download from Microsoft. It's an Excel spreadsheet. You can put in your specifics about your types of users, the amount of mail traffic that they send and receive, the size of their mailboxes, various other parameters that describe your business requirements. And this will tell you what you need. It will predict what Exchange is going to use on your hardware. It does round up a bit to be a little conservative. We want it to do that because this is designed to be a generic tool and encompass as many nuances as possible. But it doesn't cover everything. So be aware that things like third-party tools that we don't have visibility into are not going to be covered by this. So you may have additional steps that you have to go through beyond just using the calculator. If you're using BlackBerry in your environment, you'll need to add some additional resources based on their guidance. That's one example. Backup tools, any sort of line of business applications that may impact Exchange performance, that's above and beyond what the calculator predicts. So just be aware of that. Really important, 2010 and 2013 have different what we call baselines for our performance guidance. And the calculator predicts something that we call megacycles, basically the units of processing that are required on a per-user basis for the Exchange product. You can't directly compare the 2010 prediction for your deployment and the 2013 prediction for your deployment. It's going to look really awful, but you're not actually comparing something that can be compared. It is true, absolutely, that 2013 uses more CPU than 2010, potentially about twice as much. But if you try and compare the megacycle numbers, it's going to look like 6, 7, 8 times, and that's not accurate. So just be aware of that. When you go through the calculations, it removes that issue of the baseline changing. So just, you know, the final answer is accurate. Just be careful with comparisons. So when I started doing performance work for Exchange about 15 years ago, we didn't care so much about power utilization of servers in the data center. You know, we had machines that were very, very power inefficient. With the density of hardware that we're putting into data centers today, power and cooling is a major concern for anyone with any data center of a reasonable size. And when you start thinking about power considerations for server deployment, there's a lot of options on the table. Windows has options for managing power utilization, where it can run with different power profiles. Some of the hardware that you can purchase has options in the BIOS for managing power. Our recommendation for Exchange servers is to not use any of the BIOS settings, basically disable power management in the BIOS, let Windows handle the power management, and our general guidance for Exchange is to select the high-performance power plan. Balanced is an option. I believe Balanced is the default in current versions of Windows, and that will allow Windows to do some things behind the scenes to try and part cores, you know, basically power down things that it can in order to conserve energy. We find that on heavily loaded Exchange machines, you do see some benefit from the high-performance power plan, so worth considering. But the biggest thing to remain aware of here is that we really don't want the BIOS settings set to manage power. We have seen a number of performance escalations from customers into support, where Windows and the hardware are both attempting to manage power. That does not work well. That's asking for trouble. When you have two different systems that are trying to optimize for the same thing, it's bound to fail. So let Windows do it. It does a great job of it. Turn it off in the BIOS. Hyperthreading is another interesting point for Exchange 2013. Hyperthreading, symmetric multithreading, SMT, fantastic technology. Basically, providing the ability to have multiple threads ready to run on a given processor core. So you basically end up seeing multiple virtual processors for every physical processor core that you have, but not actually having those additional physical processor cores running and consuming power, consuming resources. So you're basically increasing CPU throughput via hyperthreading. The challenge for Exchange, and the reason in 2013 we strongly recommend not turning it on, is that by increasing the number of virtual processors on the machine, our memory utilization can increase dramatically. All of our memory management in Exchange 2013, with one minor exception, is memory managed by the .NET framework. Managed code, essentially, running on the box. When .NET managed processes start up, they allocate what we call heaps, areas of memory, and the number of heaps allocated for some of the processes on the box will be based on the number of virtual processors that it sees. So even before Exchange has done any work, even before any users have connected, you can actually essentially double the amount of memory being consumed by those processes on the box just by having hyperthreading enabled. So what we did prior to releasing the product is we went through and looked at what the actual CPU gain was that you would typically see with Exchange with hyperthreading on. And we saw about a 25% gain in throughput. Now, you're not always going to get 25%. It's going to vary. It's going to be somewhere between 0 and probably 30% or so. So you can't assume that it's always going to be there, which means you can't use it in your sizing calculations. It's just sort of gravy. It's, you know, this extra thing on top that is sometimes going to help you, but not always. And we looked at that and compared it to the amount of additional memory required on the box because of this memory utilization change. And our determination was that it made more sense to leave hyperthreading off because the gain was small on the CPU side compared to the increase in memory. That's the reasoning here. So there's one caveat to this. How many of you virtualize Exchange? OK. I'm not going to argue with you. I have no problem with that. We're quite happy that folks virtualized today. So if you're virtualizing, you can absolutely leave hyperthreading turned on your hypervisor hosts. That's totally fine. In the sizing process, do not include those additional hyperthreaded CPUs in the calculations to figure out how much processing horsepower you have on the box. That's point number one. Point number two, in a virtualized deployment, make sure that you're only allocating the number of virtual CPUs that you've sized for. Because if you increase virtual CPUs, which you can easily do in a virtualized deployment, you're going to run into the same problem. Exchange is going to be allocating more memory because that virtual CPU count is higher, and you're not actually taking advantage of that. You don't need that additional CPU. So, you know, you're allocating more memory than you need simply because you over-allocated CPU. So be careful with that. But that's the virtualization caveat to this. There's one other major thing that we really want to see people do to help tune Exchange on current versions of the Windows operating system. And that's installation of the .NET framework version 4.5.2 or later. 4.5.2 is sort of the minimum for us. And when I've done previous versions of this session, this used to say 4.5.1 with a bunch of hot fixes, one of which you had to go set a reg key to enable. I think both of them were not available in the download centers, so you had to call support and ask for them. Don't have to worry about that anymore. All we want is 4.5.2. There's no reg keys to set. Don't have to call support. Just make sure you're running at least this version of the .NET framework. There's very, very important fixes for Exchange in this version and later that can dramatically reduce the memory allocation or the memory utilization for Exchange and can allow us to scale and deal with peak load much better. So very, very critical here, especially if you're going to use MAPI over HTTP, which I'm not going to cover in detail in this session, but it's essentially a replacement for Outlook Anywhere as a connectivity method to Exchange 2013 that we introduced in Service Pack 1, and that's starting to come out in the Outlook client. It's available today in Outlook 2013, will be available in Outlook 2010 as well. MAPI over HTTP benefits greatly on the CAS role from this from .NET 4.5.2, excuse me. When we think about networking, we've tried to make our guidance from a networking perspective as simple as possible for 2013. Has anyone read the blog post on the Exchange preferred architecture? A few of you? Okay. So there's a link to it here in the slide deck. It's basically a description of the product team's view on the best way to deploy Exchange. Now, it's probably not going to apply 100% to any of your deployments. It really only applies to one deployment, and that's Office 365. You know, we architected Exchange 2013 to work fantastically for Exchange Online, be the best platform that we could conceive of for a very high-scale service like Exchange Online. There are aspects of that architecture that provide benefits to everyone in this room. But there are some nuances to it that won't apply. So essentially, the goal of the preferred architecture is to give you some direction. We want you to be able to pick the things that make sense for your deployment and adhere to the preferred architecture as much as possible. But just be aware that we certainly understand there will be aspects of it that that don't apply. So the important thing here from a networking perspective is that in 2013, we've changed our guidance from having multiple networks on a box where you're potentially separating your DAG replication traffic, your MAPI load, potentially having even more network interfaces on the box than that for things like NIC teaming to deal with handling failed network interfaces in a seamless manner. What we really want to see people do is just use one network interface. That's it. We don't care if it fails because the DAG is resilient, right? We look at a NIC failure as a server failure. You should be deploying enough machines in your environment that you can handle a server failure, and that NIC failure is treated the same way. So rather than go through the complexity of having multiple network interfaces, making sure that that your routing tables are set up properly and that DNS is configured properly on those interfaces so that everything works seamlessly, one network interface, that's it. Very simple. We definitely want to see people using the offload features that are available on modern network interface cards. Now, this is another area where our guidance has changed. Back in the Exchange 2003 days, when we first saw support for receive-side scaling and other offload technologies, the Exchange team's guidance was run away from those as fast as you possibly can, turn them off, we see all kinds of problems, we don't want you to use them. That's no longer the case. RSS is absolutely critical to allow you to take advantage of modern hardware and actually scale that network utilization. If you don't have RSS enabled, the first CPU core in your hardware is going to be processing all of your network load. CPU 0, you will see a very high utilization that correlates with your network utilization. RSS is essentially allowing that to be spread out across multiple CPU cores in the box, giving you much better results in terms of handling user load and dealing with peaks, particularly when you're looking at 10 gig Ethernet. Anyone deploying 10 gig Ethernet as a standard in their data centers today? Okay, that's about twice as many hands as I saw raised a few months ago. It's coming. It's starting to get to make more sense financially, economically. So as you start to scale to that volume of data traffic, RSS is a necessity. You have to use it. So use the defaults for offload settings. Don't try and tune it beyond just making sure these features are enabled. Let Windows deal with the tuning for you behind the scenes. That's the best practice there. One of the things that I did in preparation for producing this guidance was to go through the best practices that the Windows team provides for performance tuning. And they actually have a very well-written white paper that they've done for, I think, every release of Windows that I've been involved with, where they go through all the different things that can be changed in the operating system. Little tweaks that you can make in the registry and config files, you know, ways to think about trying to get the most out of your hardware based on OS changes. Well, IIS, Internet Information Server, is part of Windows. And that document includes a bunch of tuning tweaks for IIS, essentially to allow you to, you know, to get the most out of the web server in IIS, and you know, ensure that it performs favorably compared to some of the competitors in that space. In general, our guidance is don't bother tuning any of those things. We like the defaults. Exchange is really designed and tested to run with those defaults. There are a couple of things that we actually change when Exchange is set up and we create IIS virtual servers and virtual directories. We're, you know, making the decision on your behalf to tune those things based on our testing and our experience running Exchange online at scale. So in general, we want you to keep the defaults in place. Be aware that if you do try and tune those defaults beyond what we set and set up, you may run into some unexpected difficulties. And you know, having a plan for backing those out, having strong change management in place to, you know, make sure you've documented the change, very critical if you're going to do that. So, getting to the page file. This is another area where I don't really want to say recently. We changed our guidance in the middle of the Microsoft Exchange conference. I think it was back in March of this year. Just to give you an idea of how in flux some of our best practices are, while I was in Austin, Texas, attending MEC, we were actually having a discussion amongst various folks in the product group and our support organization over email. And literally the night before the session where I was delivering performance and sizing information, we decided to make this change. So we actually posted a blog article the morning of my session, announced it there. That's been our best practices guidance ever since. With the growth of memory sizes on the servers that you're deploying today for Exchange, our old guidance of set your page file size to be equal to size of memory plus 10 megs doesn't make any sense. That's way too big of a page file for Exchange. It does not need it. So what we decided to do was use what we've learned from running, we'll just say, many, many servers in Exchange online and provide the exact same configuration that we use in the service to everyone else that's deploying 2013. And that is to cap the page file size at 32,778 megs, which is basically 32 gigs plus 10 megs. I won't go into details on the 10 megs. It actually makes no sense. It's there for legacy reasons. And I can't really justify it, but that's exactly the setting that we use on our servers in the service, and we want you to be consistent with that. So if you're using at least 32 gigs on your servers, which I expect most of you are, that's what we want to see set for the page file size. We do want it to be set to a fixed size page file on those servers, rather than allowing Windows to manage it and just setting this as the cap. If Windows needs to expand the page file, which can happen when you're under peak load and Exchange is trying really hard to handle those incoming transactions from users, we don't want the operating system and the file system dealing with that page file expansion. We want it actually performing real Exchange work to make sure that we're providing the best experience to your end users. So fixed size page file helps with that. Now, as we go through the rest of the session, you'll start to see some of these tables appear on the slides that I have here. And some of these will just contain a list of perf counters. Some of them will contain something else on the right. Those are recommended thresholds to keep an eye on when you're monitoring your deployment. Today, we don't have documentation out on the web that describes all the performance counters that we think you should look at and what the thresholds are. So I'm providing some insight into what we recommend at a high level, what we look at in the service as we're monitoring Exchange Online, so that you can do some of the same things. I'm not trying to be as comprehensive as the documentation we've provided historically, but if you take a look at the counters that I've provided, this should go a long way towards allowing you to ensure that you have a healthy Exchange system from a performance perspective. So when we think about memory utilization and how the page file is part of that, it's really two counters that we like to look at. We want to make sure that the committed bytes in use is less than 80%, and that we have at least 5% of RAM available for use on the box at all times. If you start to exceed these thresholds, it's likely the case that you need to add more memory to those machines. So just be aware of that. So moving from memory into storage, and actually the page file is a nice transition because it sort of sits in between. One of the biggest problems that we see in terms of calls into Microsoft support for Exchange issues, particularly around storage performance, is use of what we call storage tiering technology. This is my trademarked graphic for don't use storage tiering. So there's two different types of storage tiering that we typically see, automatic and manual. So when we talk about manual tiering, what we're essentially talking about there is having multiple types of storage. You might have a tier of storage that's large, slow drives like SATA or midline SAS, and a tier of very low capacity but fast drives like SSD. You could have those set up as JBOD, you could have them set up as RAID arrays, and manual tiering means essentially that you're making the choice ahead of time to place certain sets of data on one of those tiers. So in prior releases of Exchange, we might have seen people deploy your primary mailboxes on your fast drives and deploy your archive mailboxes on your slow drives. That's kind of an outdated way to think about storage utilization for the Exchange product. But it's certainly happened in the past, and we see people kind of carrying that architecture forward. We really don't want you to deploy that way. And I'll explain why in a minute. The other type of tiering is what we call automatic tiering. And this is actually even more scary for us and where we see most of the problems. So there are a number of intelligent storage platforms out there in the market today that will attempt to monitor what blocks on disk are being accessed most frequently and move those automatically into a fast storage tier. Fantastic for some types of workloads. Really not fantastic for Exchange. Because of what Exchange does against databases, with background database maintenance where we're constantly performing streaming read operations, running start to finish throughout the entire database, constantly, 24 hours a day, because of the random nature of the way users interact with their mailboxes, this type of technology really does not benefit Exchange in the way that it does other workloads. So we recommend not using it. The concern is that you can actually get jet stress tests that will pass on this type of hardware and then go into production and discover that you actually have very undersized storage for your Exchange requirements. So if you're using this type of deployment today, be aware that you're essentially adding some additional risk into your deployment. And it may make sense to figure out if there's a less complex storage option available to you. We really don't require a lot out of storage in 2013. We want to have slow drives, still providing, you know, that minimum level of latency that we need to provide good end user experience. But we want capacity, not fast I/O. That's the key. So you hopefully will be able to find a solution to that if you're in this situation today. Exchange 2007, 2010, and 2013, all three of those releases really thought quite a bit about ensuring that we run very well on direct attached storage. We kind of started down that path in 2007, and we've, you know, I don't want to say perfected it, but we've certainly done a great job of ensuring that we run very well on DAS in 2013. There are a couple of things that we do recommend adjusting if you're running on DAS. So out of the box, you'll typically have a storage controller that sits between the operating system and your hard drives. That storage controller is going to have varying levels of intelligence. Some of them will perform some caching, some won't. And those that do perform caching will typically have some options in terms of how that cache is allocated. The defaults that come with those devices typically are wrong for an Exchange workload. So we actually recommend on multi-roller mailbox servers, basically any server that has the mailbox role on it, configuring the storage cache on those controllers for 100% write cache. We don't benefit from read cache on those controllers. So, you know, you may be set to 50-50 or 25-75. You're basically just kind of throwing away resources if you're configured that way. 100% write cache, we see major benefit from that. On other roles, so if you're splitting out CAS onto separate servers today, and you really shouldn't, we'll talk about that in a minute, but if you are, 25% write cache and 75% read cache actually does make sense in that type of deployment. Same thing for AD servers. So that's our guidance for the, you know, kind of three primary roles. If you're running Edge, the 100% write cache guidance would apply there as well. Basically, anything with an Exchange database on it, 100% write cache. How many of you use SSL offload in your deployments? Anybody? A few. OK. Good. Happy to see that. I worked on that feature. Worked on bringing it back in Service Pack 1. Glad that someone's actually taking advantage of it. So SSL offload refers to the ability to basically take the processing load off of Exchange for managing the encryption and decryption of SSL traffic coming into to the product. Since essentially all the major workloads for Exchange, all the major client types are using HTTPS in Exchange 2013, SSL can actually be a fairly significant consumer of processing time on your servers. And SSL offload is one way to deal with that. Essentially what you're saying is, I'm going to unencrypt my traffic between some device that sits in front of Exchange and my Exchange CAS servers, and I'm just going to let that device manage the SSL encryption and decryption. You have to be okay with having that traffic unencrypted between those two points, but if that's okay with you, this is one way to potentially gain back some CPU on your CAS servers. Now, CAS is not a very resource-intensive role in 2013. It doesn't really do a heck of a lot. It's basically an intelligent proxy. So the benefit for SSL offload may not actually be all that big of a deal. And you're adding a bunch of complexity to your system, a bunch of additional opportunities for mistakes, configuration problems, et cetera. So my guidance would be, unless you have a really clear need to use SSL offloading, or if you've used it in the past and you want to reuse your load balancer configurations and just carry that forward, you know, that might make sense. But unless you actually have a good reason to use this, probably not the right thing to do. There will be a noticeable reduction in CAS CPU, but if your CAS CPU is 5% of the box to begin with, probably not worth it. So just be aware of that. We have guidance on the web about how to configure this. Get familiar with PowerShell. not really an option in the UI for Exchange. But it is something you can do. So I'm going to briefly talk about virtualization. And I think that's important given the number of hands that I saw raised when I asked about how many were virtualizing Exchange. So at prior Tech Eds, I've done a session on virtualization best practices. This is essentially getting the key points from that hour and 15 minutes of content on one slide. That session's fairly repetitive, so it's easy to do this. In general, don't overcommit anything. Now, I realize that goes against one of the major tenets of virtualization, right? When you virtualize physical hardware onto virtual machines, one of the things that you're trying to do is perform server consolidation. You want to get more benefit out of that hardware, right? Well, we see major problems with Exchange when it can't get to CPU that it thinks that it has access to. So CPU oversubscription for Exchange is asking for trouble. Our guidance for deploying on Hyper-V, VMware's best practices for deploying Exchange on VMware, both agree with this. Do not oversubscribe CPU. Same thing goes for memory. And this memory is even clearer. Do not oversubscribe, use dynamic memory, use ballooning, any technology that messes with memory behind the scenes, don't use it with an Exchange server. We don't support it with 2013. It was strongly discouraged with prior releases. We say it's just unsupported for 2013. The reason is, when Exchange starts up, we go look at the configuration on the box, and we make some decisions based on that. One of the things we're looking at is the size of memory. We're going to go allocate jet cache, store ESE cache, based on that size of memory. And if that amount of memory that's actually available to us behind the scenes has changed, we're not aware of it. So we may be quite happily using, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes of jet cache, and that jet cache may actually end up getting forcibly paged out to the page file at the guest virtual machine layer. Or, depending on the hypervisor that you're using, you may actually see it go out to a swap file, the hypervisor level. Not a great place for your jet cache to be. I would much rather have store going to disk than going to an area that it thinks is in memory that's actually resulting in probably going to even slower disk to get access to some data that a user's requesting at that moment in time. So don't use any of those memory technologies. I mentioned earlier that hyper-threading is totally okay for a virtualized deployment. But for sizing, just to reiterate, don't use those virtual cores. Just size based on physical cores. One additional thing to call out. As hardware continues to get bigger and bigger, more and more processor sockets in the box, more and more processor cores per physical processor, you see the term NUMA thrown out a lot these days, non-uniform memory access. It's essentially a way for the hardware that you're running on to provide some hints to the operating system and to applications about the location of memory relative to particular CPUs, so that an application and the operating system can optimize use of memory for basically the fastest possible paths between the CPU and a given piece of memory. Applications that are very much designed for scale-up, I'll use SQL Server as an example, have spent a whole bunch of time figuring out how to use that NUMA information and take advantage of it and gain better performance from it. Exchange is not NUMA aware. If that information is presented to us, we happily ignore it and just go right on our merry way doing whatever we were going to do if that information wasn't presented to us. So VMware and Hyper-V both have features now where they will present NUMA information down to guest machines. That's great. Once again, we won't do anything with it. But the operating system actually will. The operating system will do some optimization based on that information behind the scenes. And Exchange does see some benefit from that. So I don't want to tell you to turn NUMA off. Our best practice here is just use the defaults. Don't try and tune things, because you're not going to see benefit. Just use the VMware and Hyper-V defaults. I have seen a few support cases recently that have involved needing to tweak some NUMA settings to get the most out of Exchange on a virtualized deployment. That has not been on Hyper-V. It's been on the other platform. So there may be some new guidance coming out in that space in the near future. So just keep an eye out for that. Make sure that if there is new best practices guidance for that, that you follow that from the appropriate vendor. Exchange is extremely dependent on AD. Anyone who's been around Exchange, going back to Exchange 2000, is aware of this. Virtually all of our config information lives in AD. All of our recipient information lives in AD. The GAL, the address book, all the queries related to that, all of that information lives in this secondary system that is often sized very differently from Exchange and sometimes managed by different people. And that tends to cause issues. So what we recommend from an Exchange perspective is following our sizing guidance for AD global catalog servers that you'll be using in your Exchange sites. That shows up in the sizing guidance that I mentioned earlier. And keeping an eye on performance counters on the Exchange side to make sure that you're not seeing massive increases in LDAP search time. It's one example performance counter that could indicate sizing problems or performance problems on your Active Directory machines. In addition, just looking at CPU time on your AD servers and trending that over time, very simple thing to do, but can be a great way to gain insight into potential problems and solve those problems before they actually impact Exchange. Exchange does a lot of work against AD behind the scenes that you might not expect. So sure, logging a user in, we go do a bunch of work. We'll use AD for authentication. We'll use AD to go pull configuration for that user down. But there are things always going on behind the scenes where Exchange is constantly searching AD. And if those queries start to slow down, Exchange is going to get unhealthy very quickly. So be careful here. We do continue to recommend deploying enough RAM on your Active Directory global catalogs for your Exchange sites such that the entire AD database lives in RAM. It's a very critical thing to do to make sure that AD query performance is very speedy for Exchange's needs. So be aware of that. So this is a sort of related topic when we talk about AD. Anyone here know what I'm talking about when we start talking about NTLM and Max Concurrent API? Okay. So this is an interesting problem that you can run into with Exchange. We've certainly saw a lot of it with 2010. You can still hit this problem with 2013. What we're talking about here is a bottleneck that's built into the architecture of NTLM authentication. Essentially, the way NTLM works is a fixed number of NTLM authentications that can be performed by a given machine at any given time. So, to kind of give you a concrete example, if I'm coming in from an Outlook client that's using NTLM to authenticate to a CAS server, that CAS server is going to go through that process of authentication. It's going to get some credential information, and it's going to need to go to an Active Directory server to actually follow through on that authentication request. There's a maximum number of those requests that CAS server can send to AD at any given time. That's what we're talking about with Max Concurrent API. It's basically a setting in the registry that you can change to adjust this. Additionally, if I have a multi-forest deployment or a multi-domain deployment with trusts in place, AD may then need to go to another domain or another forest to go actually perform the real authentication. AD is going to do the exact same thing. It's an RPC call behind the scenes to go to another domain controller and perform the NTLM auth. The same bottleneck applies there. So what we've run into over the years are problems that typically started with some sort of failure mode in Exchange. You might have a load balancer that tips over and results in few thousand clients getting disconnected all at once, and boy, is Outlook really, really excited about reconnecting. When Outlook gets disconnected behind the scenes, it's going to try again and try again and try again to reconnect as fast as it possibly can. And if you have thousands of clients doing that simultaneously, or in the case of one of the customers I worked with that ran into this, hundreds of thousands of clients attempting to do this simultaneously, and you're using NTLM auth, it's not going to work. You're basically going to build a giant queue of these. You're going to see timeouts all over the place. And Outlook, being the helpful client that it is just going to keep trying. Very bad situation to be in. So there's a few performance counters to keep an eye on, just to understand whether or not you're actually running into this problem at a less impactful level, so that you can try and avoid it if you run into one of those failure modes. These are worth looking at on AD, on CAS, and on Mailbox. Anywhere that an authentication activity might actually be performed. There's a link down here at the bottom. It's a great document that provides kind of end-to-end the definition for what these counters tell you, and how to actually go tune things to make sense for your environment. So just be aware of this. We do still see this with 2013, and wherever possible, we want to make sure you avoid it. So probably the most important topic that I can bring up, besides sizing, for how to think about optimizing Exchange, is thinking about what we call balance. We like to think about balance in different ways at different levels in the system. We want your system to be as balanced as possible across all the hardware that you're using, across your user base, across your CAS servers, and I'll talk about what I mean for all the different roles on the slides that we're talking about that I'll be going through next. But essentially, balance gives you better availability, better user experience, and a more predictable system to manage and operate. That's the key thing to be aware of here. So thinking about the first layer of interaction that your users have with Exchange, the CAS layer. Balance here is really important. We've talked in 2013 about simplifying load balancing and said that, you know, as opposed to 2010, where you needed a very intelligent load balancer that could, for all the different protocols that Exchange supports, you know, do different things, use cookie-based affinity, use source IP-based affinity, do all this complex processing at the load balancer layer. We eliminated the need for all that in 2013. That's true, but we still want some layer of load balancing at that level, if at all possible, because we want two things. We want connections spread out as evenly as possible across CAS servers, and we want detection of failure, so that if one of those CAS servers fails for whatever reason, and everything fails, I fail, software fails, hardware fails, everything eventually fails. When that failure occurs, we want the load balancer to detect that and not send additional connections there. Right? We want those connections to then be spread out evenly across the remaining CAS servers. If you get into a state where all or most of your connections are hitting a single CAS, that CAS is going to be overwhelmed, and you're going to have a very poor user experience. Seems obvious, but we run into this again and again and again. Make sure that you're running some form of load balancing in front of CAS if you care about availability and user experience. It's the key. Most load balancers have an option to tune what they call the connection distribution policy or load balancing policy. These are things like leased connections or round robin. Those are very common options. Be careful with leased connections. If you choose leased connections, which is often the default, what the load balancer is going to do is when a new connection comes in, it's going to look at the number of connections that it's managing to each one of your CAS servers and send that connection to the CAS server that has the least number of connections. Makes sense, right? The problem occurs when you get into a failure mode. So if I lose a CAS server, well, I'm still okay. All those users are going to reconnect, and I'm going to send them to the CAS server that has the least number of connections. Okay, now I bring that failed CAS server back up and running. Guess who has the least number of connections? Namely, zero. That CAS server that just failed. Now if I have any sort of additional network hiccup that causes reconnects, that machine is just going to get flooded. It's going to get pounded. That is another place where we often see support escalations and really bad problems with Exchange. So there's ways to mitigate that. Using round robin instead of lease connections is one. Some load balancer vendors have what they call slow start that essentially modifies lease connections and says that instead of just sending many, many, many connections all at once to that server that has the least number of connections, we'll slowly ramp it up over time with some configuration parameters. That's okay too. That works perfectly well in addition. It's not available on all load balancer products. So the goal here is as much as possible to have an equal number of inbound connections on your CAS servers. And the perf counter that I have here is not going to give you the perfect answer for whether or not you're perfectly balanced, but it's going to show you for all the protocols that use web access. So that'll be Outlook Anywhere, OWA, Exchange Active Sync, Exchange Web Services, any of these protocols, their connections will get reflected in this perf counter. Not going to reflect SMTP, POP, IMAP, those types of connections, but this is still a good indicator. As much as possible, you want to see this have an equal number or a close to equal number across your CAS servers. That's the goal. So within a DAG, a database availability group of mailbox servers, what we want here is well-balanced active copies. So we've had DAGs for a couple of releases now. So I don't need to go into a huge amount of detail on what a DAG is and how it works. But essentially, you have multiple copies of a database. One of those copies is active at any given time. And that's servicing load for end users. Given the architecture of Exchange 2013, all of the work that Exchange is doing for a given user is going to occur on the mailbox server that's hosting the active copy of that user's database. So the most important thing that you can do to balance load is ensure that you have you're basically balancing users as much as possible across databases and balancing the number of active copies as much as possible across your mailbox servers. The perf counter that I have down at the bottom of the slide shows you the number of essentially active databases that you have on a mailbox server. You want that to be as close to equal across your mailbox servers in the DAG as you possibly can. That's the key. Now, failures are going to happen. I mentioned that. We have to design for them and expect them to occur. And when those do occur, you're going to get out of balance. And that's okay, because the sizing process is designed to handle that. Right? We have some overhead in the system to deal with that imbalance. Not a problem. But the system is not going to automatically rebalance itself when you deal with that hardware failure, whether it's a failed disk that you've replaced, a failed server that you've replaced. You're still going to have that database copy activation in place from when the failure occurred. So be prepared to manually go back in and rebalance. There is a script that ships with Exchange that can be used to rebalance databases. You can actually run it as a scheduled task if you like. That may be a best practice to actually to manage this. Redistribute active databases .ps1 is the script. So now we start going to a lower level. Talked about balancing database copies. What about what's in those databases? Well, those databases really represent two things. They represent content, the amount of message content that users are storing in those mailboxes. That has an impact on capacity utilization and storage. And they also represent users who are going to perform activity against the server and consume CPU. So there's a couple of things you need to keep in mind. Balancing space utilization. Some of your users are going to have huge mailboxes. Some of them are going to have really tiny mailboxes. And if your deployment's big enough, you might be able to just randomly spread people out and not care. And that random distribution will get you close to balanced. Most likely, that's not going to work for you. There are very few deployments in the world where a random distribution is going to give you the right balance to actually achieve what you're looking for here. So what we recommend is trying to think about, from a space utilization perspective, spread out large consumers of space, spread out small consumers of space. So on a given database, have some of your gigantic mailboxes, have some of your small mailboxes. This is going to accomplish two things. You're going to get more equal distribution of space utilization across your databases, but we also typically see that users with large mailboxes have different activity profiles compared to users with smaller mailboxes. So you're also going to be balancing activity that's going to result in IOPS and CPU consumption for those databases. If you actually have more insight into how your users work against Exchange, you can try and be a little smarter and actually, you know, on an ongoing basis, track how users are impacting the system and move them around. Be prepared, in order to maintain balance, to constantly be moving users. There's nothing wrong with moving users. That's why we have online mailbox move. In fact, in Exchange Online, at any given moment in time, we are moving thousands, maybe tens of thousands of mailboxes between servers in order to maintain balance. Just make that part of your operational processes and try and you know, keep that balance as much as possible. Going one level deeper, this is the last level that we'll go to when we're talking about balance. So within mailboxes, in prior releases of Exchange and Outlook, we used to have really, really low recommended limits on items per folder, mailbox sizes, these things that you know you really had to care quite a bit about in order to get good end user experience using those clients against Exchange. As we've started to make larger and larger mailboxes available, that guidance has changed. Right? We talk about you know sizes in the millions of items now rather than 10,000. Many orders of magnitude greater. It's still important to be aware that the system has limits. Right? It's not designed to be this unlimited dumping ground of storage for end users. It is still designed to be a partially organized set of content with a folder hierarchy. So this is particularly important when you have legacy clients. The changes that we've made in Exchange support these large item counts, high item counts, apply to Exchange and Exchange alone. In order to actually get good end user experience with those same mailboxes, you need to be on the latest clients as well. So if you're running Outlook 2007 or Outlook 2010 or something else, this may be a problem. We do have some limits built into the system that are actually lower than the on-premises limits that you get with Exchange 2013 out of the box for our service, for Exchange Online. We document those in the URL that I point to here. We actually recommend that you take a look at those limits and consider actually applying those, what we call mailbox shaping rules or limits, to your users' mailboxes as well, if you can. You may have a legitimate business need to go above those, and that's fine. But we look at those as best practices for the product. It's the same code base in the service as it is the on-premises product. So the problems that we run into with you know, exceeding those limits in the service are the same problems you're going to see with an on-premises deployment. So consider applying those limits and being a little more restrictive than we are out of the box. So I mentioned at the outset, multi-role, or not at the outset, but a few slides ago, that I'd talk about multi-role and our guidance here. We do recommend that you deploy Exchange 2013 on multi-role machines, that you don't break out mailbox and CAS. There's two really good reasons for this. First and foremost, better utilization of hardware. CAS is, like I mentioned, not doing a heck of a lot in 2013. It's an intelligent proxy. It's looking at a request saying, OK, this request is for user A. User A's database, active copy of their mailbox database is on server 3. I'm going to proxy that request over to server 3. It's really all that it's doing. There's no rendering of content or you know, deep inspection of those requests that are coming along. It's just managing that process of figuring out the right server to send to. Because the resource requirements are so low, you're typically able to use the extra headroom that you have on your mailbox servers on modern hardware to manage that CAS resource requirement. The other nice thing about multi-role is that if you're deploying in that type of topology, you'll typically have more mailbox servers than standalone CAS servers in a split role scenario. So deploying CAS on those mailbox servers means you have more CAS servers, more servers that have the CAS role. That makes you much more resilient to failure. If you have two standalone CAS servers and you lose one, well, you're down to your last CAS server. You lose another, you're dead. You're offline. No users can do anything. But if those two CAS servers are sitting in front of 10 mailbox servers, if I make those machines multi-role, I now have 10 CAS servers that can fail. Much more resilient to failure. So you can't do this if you're running a DAG and you want to use Windows NLB. Don't use Windows NLB. Please. It doesn't scale well. You will run into problems with Windows NLB. We recommend, as a best practice, use a hardware load balancer or a software load balancer running in a virtual machine. Lots of other options other than Windows NLB. So that should, we'll just remove that from the equation. Don't even think about that. The other thing to be aware of, you are going to have more machines to manage certs on. So if that's a problem, then that may be a legitimate reason to not go down this path. We think that most likely that's not going to be an issue for you. So wherever possible, multi-role. Much simpler deployment with better availability. So last slide in this section, and we'll move on to troubleshooting and talk about how to detect and resolve some issues. So this is one thing that I get questions on constantly. How big is too big? So you can go buy some really big hardware to run Exchange on these days. Please don't. We've had issues over every release of Exchange that I've been involved with on scale-up hardware, large hardware. Exchange is really architected for scale-out. It's one of the core tenets behind the high availability architecture that we have, behind database availability groups. We really want as many physical machines or virtual machines running on separate physical hardware as we can get to be resilient to failure. Additionally, the more mailboxes that you put on a given VM or given physical machine, the larger the impact when that server fails. And it will fail at some point. If you, have a very large number of not very impactful users, so let's say you have 20,000 users that do almost nothing. Well, you could theoretically go deploy those 20,000 users on a small number of servers, maybe even one server. But you have no resilience to failure. And when failure happens, you're going to have a load of trouble to deal with. Additionally, we typically see that the hardware that you would buy to scale up on, when you compare that to the cost of what we call commodity hardware, scale out smaller hardware, you're typically paying a premium for that scale-up system. So in many cases, you can actually spend less money overall to buy more servers and get better availability with Exchange. Now, that's not always going to hold true. I can't stand up here and say that the discount percentage that you get from your hardware vendor is going to be the same for commodity hardware and scale-up hardware, and so the math is always going to work out that way. I can't do that. That wouldn't be true. But in general, 2U commodity servers tend to be a much better way to go. So when we architect Exchange these days, we do it for our own use in Exchange Online. I mentioned that earlier. When we deploy in Exchange Online, we're deploying on 2U hardware with two physical processor slots. Now, modern processors can have 10 or more cores on them. So some of those machines have 20 cores in them. It's a fairly large server by the standards of a couple years ago, but still two physical processor sockets. Size of memory on those machines is about 96 gigs, and they have 12 midline SAS or SATA drives in them, so the storage is actually built into the box. We don't have any need for any more complexity for the storage consumption. So That's talked about in our preferred architecture documentation. We recommend that if you can, that you consider deploying in a similar manner. If you can't deploy something that looks exactly like that, maybe consider doing something similar in a virtual deployment. You know, don't go above that 16 to 20 cores on your VMs. Don't go above something like 96 gigs of RAM on those VMs. Think about deploying the size of storage on a per server basis to be equal to what you might see from a server with 12 high capacity drives. Try and mimic that as much as possible. The more aligned you are with the architectural choices we've made in the product, the better your experience is going to be. And most likely, the more you'll be able to reuse that hardware and that design as you look at future versions of Exchange. That's key to remember. So, the last point on here, we don't push the top end. We're not testing on big hardware. We don't know what happens. But I don't like to just assume that things are going to work. I've been around long enough to know that they don't when we make assumptions like that. So I don't want you to run into a situation where things fall over because you're on hardware that we haven't tested on at that scale, and things just don't work. So let's move on to troubleshooting. And we should have time for a couple questions. Realize, once again, this is going to be a very high-level overview of how to troubleshoot Exchange from a perf perspective. So where do we begin? A couple things to define. What are the symptoms? What's impacted? It's fairly straightforward. But really important to take a measured approach to troubleshooting performance. There's a lot of data that you're going to end up going through in the process of looking at a perf problem on Exchange. If you don't go into it with a plan, and you're not thoughtful about it, these types of problems can take weeks, months of time to actually detect and resolve. So if you understand the resource impact, you can be as clear as possible about that, then we can try and isolate the cause by working back from what's consuming those resources. So what I'm talking about there are things like the physical resources on your box. Is CPU impacted? Is memory impacted? Is network impacted? Is storage impacted? It's probably going to be one of those primarily, and maybe more than one at a higher level. Focus on the one thing that's impacted the most and work from there. We do recommend absolutely prioritizing service availability. Wherever possible, collect the data you need to go resolve the problem, but if there's something you can do to get the service back online quickly, do that. Try not to actually impact your end users for an extended period of time while you're troubleshooting these types of problems. Because if it is going to take a week to go actually resolve the problem, you don't want to have periods of downtime during that window. If you can move databases around, move users around in order to minimize impact, absolutely worth doing. So when we think about CPU, two types of CPU consumption, user mode and kernel mode. User mode means basically anything other than what the operating system or the drivers are doing. The kernel mode would be the OS and the drivers. We do occasionally see high CPU utilization in kernel mode. I've seen deployments in our data centers where we had a bad keyboard driver or a bad keyboard port that resulted in the keyboard driver consuming 100% of the CPU on a physical core and actually impacting Exchange. Typically, if you see high kernel CPU, drivers are the place to look. And there are troubleshooting steps that are a little bit outside of the scope of what I'm talking about here today that you can take to go figure out which driver is causing the problem. But if it's user mode, then you can go look at per process CPU utilization in the process counters down here at the bottom. That should actually be percent. User time rather than privilege time. Apologies for that. And that will tell you for each one of the processes running on the box how much CPU time they're consuming. Then you can zero in on the process that's causing the problem. So, very helpful to have a baseline when we're looking at CPU problems. Is this abnormal? Right? Do I normally see CPU going up at this time during the day and we just happen to be going up higher? Or is this, a totally random peak that just occurred? Those are two very different problems to solve. If it's load related, additionally, if it correlates with an increase in connections or an increase in operations per second, that might indicate a client issue, right? Do I have a misbehaving client, a misbehaving mobile device that's causing issues? Correlating that way is one way to try and troubleshoot where that CPU is coming from. You can see that via some of the perf counters on a per workload basis or a per protocol basis for connections and operations per second. If you're tracking those over time, you'll have a much easier way to correlate those together. I'm not going to talk about workload management other than to say that when your servers are in sort of a lull, doing less work, Exchange will go perform background operations behind the scenes, and you might see a spike in CPU. Nothing to worry about if that's workload management, and these perf counters can tell you what whether that's happening. Memory. Hard to troubleshoot on Exchange. Most of our memory is managed by the .NET framework these days. So there's a couple of key counters to look at on your servers to understand if you're under memory pressure. I mentioned the percent committed bytes in use and available megabytes earlier when we were talking about page file. Those are very important to keep an eye on. The other one is for the .NET CLR, the amount of time you're spending doing garbage collection. We want to see that counter below 10%. If it's above 10%, there's a couple possible things going on. Not enough memory on the box, so we're doing garbage collection more because we're under memory pressure, or potentially you have a broader performance problem. Could be a bug in the code, could be based on end-user interactions with the server. Hard to say, but adding more memory is a good first step to try and resolve that. Storage perf, we've gotten really good at this over releases of Exchange. Not a heck of a lot of changes here from prior releases. Our thresholds are really still the same as they were in the last couple of releases. Latencies are what we really care most about, right? We're sizing to some extent for the number of IOPS that we need, but we need to make sure that those IO operations are running quickly and staying under these latencies. So those are the key numbers to look at. There are a whole bunch of things that can impact latency. Way more than I could go through in a session. But these are a few things to look at that can and do impact latency that we see via support escalations. So one thing that you can do if you are seeing high I/O latency is go and look and see if you're actually experiencing an increase in IOs, in IOPS, that correlates with that increase in latency. It's possible that your system is doing more than it should be due to client issues, due to more users than you sized for, and that's actually resulting in bottlenecks and high I/O latency. You can also use SysInternals Process Monitor to understand exactly what I/O is happening behind the scenes on the box. It's another fantastic tool. Sometimes the I/O that's happening has nothing to do with Exchange. An antivirus scanning drives that it shouldn't or something like that. Process Monitor can help you with that. And last but not least, when you're looking at performance on an Exchange system, there's really one counter, I know there's more than one on the slide, but there's one counter to rule them all, and that's the first one, RPC average latency. That indicates the amount of time that it's taking for remote procedure calls to happen within the Exchange system. And if you're seeing any sort of a performance problem that impacts Exchange transactions, it's going to be reflected in this counter. So monitoring that, trending it, keeping an eye on it, extremely critical. And 100 milliseconds is actually a really high threshold. I'd like to see this below 20 milliseconds in general. 100 milliseconds means you really have a problem. So if in doubt, call Microsoft. We have fantastic performance troubleshooting capacity within our support organization. And they can do a great job of using some of our internal debugging tools to go figure out what's going on. So last couple of slides here in the last couple of minutes. So, Exchange 2013 captures perf data by default. There's a service running in the box called EDS, the Exchange Diagnostic Service, that saves perf logs for a default configured amount of time in the logging directory that's under the install directory for Exchange. This is a great place to go if you run into a performance problem and you want to understand what the system looked like yesterday when you weren't experiencing that problem. You know, without doing any trending on your own, without collecting data on your own, you've got a few days worth of data there that you can use for troubleshooting. Additionally, since that data is already there in BLG files, you can go load it into SQL, collect it over time, use it for trending. The Relog tool that ships with Windows will take a BLG file and load it into SQL for you. And you can point perfmon at that SQL server for a large window of time and use that for analysis. So this slide, and the slides will be available after the session. You don't have to take pictures of all of them. This gives you the command line that you can use to load a perf log into SQL. From there, once the data is in SQL, you point perfmon to it. You can also point Excel at it. Excel is probably the most important tool that I use for perf analysis. It's fantastic for looking at large quantities of data. So both of those tools are great for looking at your perfmon counters. From there, we recommend building a scorecard. Keep an eye on a few key counters, and as part of your operational rhythm, report on those. Show how Exchange is trending over time. Are we consuming 20% more CPU month over month? Are we using 30% more storage month over month? If you get into this rhythm of reporting and trending, you will have a much healthier deployment. You won't run into problems where you, at the last minute, have to add, you know, double the storage because your users are consuming more than you expected. Much better situation to be in. So, in summary, sizing, number one most important thing you can do to have a healthy Exchange 2013 deployment. Balance, next most important thing. Make sure you're balanced of all the different layers in the system. We do want to see you deploy multi-role. Right? Multi-role is going to be the best utilization of hardware, best availability you can get out of Exchange. And then over time, wherever possible, collect data, trend it, report on it, and make sure that Exchange is doing what it should be for you and what you expected it to do. And you may actually want to, you know, have a bit of a loop there with the sizing process. Understand what Exchange is doing and what the sizing process predicted, and see if you can figure out what the difference is. That'll help you when you size for the next version of Exchange that you want to deploy. Right? That'll help give you information about those line of business apps, those third-party tools that you may not have anticipated, and the impact they're having on the product. So with that, I don't have much time for questions. There's an email address here. That's me. Feel free to send me an email if we don't get time to cover your questions here. I'll be at Ask the Experts tonight as well. Not much related content. We do have kind of a light Exchange track here. I apologize for that. But the deployment session is a good one to go to. Scott Schnull does a great job of delivering that session. Highly encourage you attend it. And if you have further questions about Exchange or Office in general, come see us on the Tech Expo floor. I'm going to skip through this stuff real quick and just remind you to complete an eval form. Really appreciate the feedback. And with that, I will bid you a good day. Thanks.